graph.
Thank you. So I just wanted to start by acknowledging my co-authors, Stephen Gortler, and also for parts of it, Alex Healy. There's a preprint on some parts of it, but other parts you'll have to wait a little bit. And I just also wanted to start off with an illustration of the importance of this problem of rigidity. You know, if you don't pay attention to whether things are rigid, you might end up in situations like this. So let me start off with a few definitions. We're talking about rigidity of frameworks, which is a graph together with a map from its vertices to Euclidean space. And then we're interested in measuring the lengths and wondering whether those length measurements determine the framework. So precisely, a framework is locally rigid if you can't, if it's rigid, you can't budge it. So this one is local in two dimensions at least, it's locally rigid. Whereas if I remove that one diagonal, it's not. I can move it a little bit. And there's another thing we could talk about, which is global rigidity. You can ask if it's globally rigid, if every other framework, regardless of whether it's close or not, is related by an isometry. So this graph here, which was locally rigid, is not globally rigid because I can just fold that flap over. And so, and here are a few more examples. So the one on top is not locally rigid, as we saw, can budge a little bit. This one, you can't budge a little bit, but you can move it a lot. This one here is a complete graph, and it turns out every complete graph is always globally rigid, at least in Euclidean space, as we saw. Sorry, now I forget who's talking about complex hyperbolic space. Anyway, in, in some other geometries, maybe that's not true, but it is true in Euclidean space. And here's a more complicated one, which you may take a little bit of thought to convince you that it's locally but not globally rigid, or you can just look at the pictures and believe that I drew them right. Some basic cases to get rid of. If you have a complete graph, it's always globally rigid. It always determines that its length, regardless of how many vertices or what dimension. On the other hand, if you have very few vertices, if you have less than d plus 1 vertices, you have to be a complete graph, or else you have no hope of being even locally rigid. So, and there are a few special cases in some of the theorems, so I just wanted to remove those special cases. So from now on, we'll assume that we're not in those special cases. So now, this is a conference about computability, and so the first thing to admit is that this is, in fact, a very hard problem. That you could ask, if I'm given an edge length, can I realize it in d dimensions? Or if I'm given a framework and I want to know, is there another one with the same edge length? Both of those problems are NP hard, dating back to 1979. So, and the idea, you can just think about one-dimensional framework. So you just have a graph on a line, you're just measuring the lengths, it's a pretty simple thing. And if we have a cycle here, the edges can point in two different directions, so we want the edges pointing one direction to equal the sum of the edges pointing the other direction. And which is basically a partition problem, which is one of the well-known NP complete problems. So this graph here is locally but not globally rigid, whereas if I have some other edge lengths, random edge lengths, it'll be globally rigid. So this is a very short talk, right? So there are some ways out. And so if we restrict to what are called to generic frameworks. So a generic, I just mean that the coordinates of the vertices don't satisfy any algebraic condition. So this first example, the one that was not globally rigid, was not generic, whereas the second one is generic, and somehow, and you can see, it's easy to see that a generic choice of edge lengths will be globally rigid. So we remove this bit of NP hardness. And so we say a graph is generically globally rigid if it has a generic framework which is globally rigid. And so so there are sort of two main results that this is one I won't actually say much about the proof of today, but sort of background. One is that you can characterize the generically globally rigid graphs. And I'll give you the characterization in a bit in a computational tractable way. This was conjectured by Connolly back in 1980 or so. Later than that. Several years ago. And he also proved that it was a sufficient condition. And then more recently, we proved that it was also necessary. And one side effect of this characterization is that it's a generic property, that it didn't depend on which graph. You know, it didn't. My edge lengths don't matter in this example here. That if one generic framework is globally rigid, so are they all. So, this has a long history going back. These references go back to 1970. In fact, people have been thinking about the problem related problems for hundreds of years. And so the two-dimensional case is completely understood in a series of papers, ending with Jackson and Jordan in 2005. Bruce Hendrickson in 92 gave some simple necessary conditions and conjectured they were also sufficient. But that's in fact not true, and there are some counterexamples, the first of which was found by Connolly as well. And also, you know, this is a really practical problem. People care about this all the time. So, you know, very often you have some physical object and you measure the lengths, and you want to know, are those lengths enough to determine the shape of the object? And furthermore, if they are enough to determine the shape of the object, how do I find the shape? So, global rigidity is necessary for it to be well posed. This comes up all the time. For instance, molecular chemistry, if you want to find the shape of, you do nuclear MMR and you find the distance between various atoms and then you want to find the global shape of the protein. Or sensor networks where you have some, this is maybe in a forest, you have some little nodes and they can measure the distance to nearby nodes and you want to find the overall global shape. And so both of these, this is relevant. So, however, there's a slight issue with just thinking about global rigidity here, which is that that's enough to tell you whether there is a solution, whether the problem is well posed, but it's not enough to actually find the solution. That, you know, even if, like, maybe for generic values there is a solution, but then, well, how do you actually find it? So one key to finding it is to look at another concept, which is what I'm going to spend more time talking about today, which is called universal rigidity. So if we compare that to our earlier definitions, we say that a framework is universally rigid if the edge length, framework again in d dimensions, is universally rigid if its edge lengths determine the position up to isometry regardless of the embedding dimension. So if every other framework in e to the d prime for any other, for any D prime, is related to it by an isometry. And it turns out that for these graphs, there is a good algorithm to do the reconstruction problem. You can reconstruct. I'll say a little bit more about this later, but you can reconstruct using a technique called semi-definite programming. So this is,
Before you go on, so a framework doesn't have, the definition of framework does not include edge length stuff, right?
A framework is
the graph with a map of its vertices.
Yes.
So that does specify the edge length.
Then you can measure the edge lengths, right? Yes. Yes. Right.
And so when you say every other framework, you really mean that every other framework with the same edge length.
I forgot that. Yes, I have it on these slides. With the same edge length. Let me just say, so semi-definite programming. I'm sure you've all heard of linear programming. You optimize over convex polytopes. Semi-definite programming is somewhat similar, except you use a different convex shape. You take the cone of semi-definite, positive semi-definite matrices. That's a convex body. And you take slices of it, and then you optimize a linear function over that. And that's the semi-definite programming problem. And in practice, it's at least often solvable. Although not as well, not as sort of conclusively as linear programming is solvable. So let's get some examples of that. Let me just start off with some one-dimensional examples. So any simplex is going to be universally rigid. For a less trivial example, if I take a one-dimensional framework, this is supposed to be living in one dimension, and I just pulled it apart a little bit so you can see. So this one is universally rigid, whereas if I do something like this, this is not universally rigid. So we see immediately that universal rigidity is not a generic property, that a generic framework looking like this is universally rigid, one like this is not. So we have to look not just at the graph, but also at the particular framework. More examples. I can just pull it apart. I mean, just if I think about this sitting in... So in the line, it is rigid, but if in the plane, I can just pull it apart. Whereas here, like the triangle inequality forces these three to be all directly in a row. Yes?
But that one, the one that's not UR, that's not globally rigid even in one dimension.
It is. Yeah. If I had drawn it generically, it would be. As long as this length doesn't equal that length and this one doesn't equal that one. More examples. Let's see. My vertices are, well, it doesn't actually make a difference for when I'm talking about generic ones. Well, I can always flip it over. It's still related by an asymmetry.
So there's the skewing the...
Oh, Yeah. I mean, okay, so really, really, I should think about the graphs as being labeled, but it doesn't actually make a difference for generic frameworks, because it won't have any symmetries generically. So if you're looking at that example, if we look at the last one there, so this one we saw was not globally rigid in the plane, so it's also not universally rigid. If I brace it a little bit more by adding one edge, if I drew it right, I think this is indeed universally rigid. Well, I can redraw it, this, you know, the same graph. Take some thought to convince you that this is the same graph. But if I look at the same triangular prism plus a single edge, in this configuration, it's not universally rigid. More examples, just to convince you that this is indeed an old subject. There's what are called Cauchy polygons. So you take a polygon in the plane, a convex polygon, and I add sort of the diagonals connecting adjacent, not vertices that are two apart, and I add all but one of them. And it's an old theorem of Cauchy that this is, in fact, universally rigid, that this determines it. And it's crucial that it be convex, or this statement of universal rigidity is not true. They're the same graph. They're different in frameworks. They're different embeddings. And so this one, well, here I can kind of lift up this vertex and wiggle around to other things. Whereas here, the fact that I have a triangle on the outside, well, it's not just that, but it helps make it more rigid. In the plane, yes. Yes, I should always be specifying the... Right. So here's the argument that I convinced... I could be wrong. I tried to do this myself preparing for this. So here's my argument. So we have a triangle on the outside, and then this triangle here could be either this here or here. But it can't be down here because then, you know, this distance is too far to be made up with these two edges. So it has to be up here. And then similarly, this triangle here has to be folded up rather than down. And then we're done. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I'm sorry. You're right. I was doing totally the wrong problem. You're right. I'm sorry. Sorry, I take it back.
So how do you deform it in R3, let's
say? Well, you bend this up a little bit. You can bend this up a little bit, and then this one moves here. Okay, yes, I'm sorry, I didn't think through my example enough. Anyway, there are other examples. I mean, another embedding of this graph will not be universally rigid. And, well, there are other examples, just for an example, where it's always universally rigid, independent of the embedding. If I start off with a simplex, and I start, again, in two dimensions, and I add a new vertex, and then I connect it to three old vertices, and I just keep going, adding a new vertex and connecting it to at least three old vertices, like so, then this will always be universally rigid, independent of the embedding. This is called trilateralization. I can do this in any dimension, I just need to have more. In three dimensions, I would start off with a three simplex and connect to at least four previous vertices, and then that'll pin down my examples. And just, you know, one three non-collinear, right, right. Any generic embedding will be rigid, universally rigid. Okay, so enough examples. I think you understand the concept probably better than I do, in fact. So what's the technique here? Sorry, just a second. Okay, so the one of the basic ingredients are what are called stress vectors. So a stress vector, it's a function on the edges. So I take a framework and I assign numbers to the edges, like here. And then there are several different equivalent ways of saying the condition that I'd like to, that we'll, and we'll be using all, well, they're all helpful for intuition. So the first is that each vertex is the weighted average of its neighbors given by the given weights here, like so. So it's true for the circle vertex there, or again, it's true for that vertex. Yes?
So you're saying that each vertex is the weighted average. The labels are off the
edges, the undirected edges. So this, I claim that this one is the weighted average of these four vertices. Some of them are negative weights, so I'm not in the convex hull. And then the trick is to make sure that, you know, the weights are the same going both ways, that it's a symmetric thing.
Omega is
the function on the edges. Rho is the framework. Rho are the positions of the vertices. Sorry, I think that got lost in the editing, the definition of that terminology. Right. So I have the positions of the vertices, and this vertex here, rho of u, is the sum over all other w, which are connected by an edge, of the weight on the corresponding edge, times rho of w, and then normalized by the sum of the weights. Right. Although I did it. Yes. That's right. It's hard to. Although it should be sort of, well, I don't know, sort of believable that, I mean, the negative weights, for instance, are in the right places. No, they need not be integer. Any real numbers. So we could also rewrite that equation, just multiply out and bring things over to this other side, that for each vertex, I take the sum over the edges, the length of the edge times the corresponding weight. And that gives me a vector for each of the adjacent edges, 1, 2, 3, pointing in a direction depending on the vertex, and those are supposed to add up to zero. And again, that happens for each of these vertices. So now maybe it looks like something you can check, that it looks, you can check that the sum of the vectors at each vertex is equal to zero. And a nice way to reinterpret that is in terms of, imagine that I had a spring on each edge, which was pulling back inwards with a force constant given by the weight. And the one caveat is that sometimes these spring weights are negative, which they have to be, or otherwise would just shrink to zero. But in any case, they do balance out. It's in equilibrium. That's where. And then there's another condition which I want to delay until later to talk about. Okay. So So that's all I wanted to do. That's all the slides I have, so I'll continue on the black, using the whole blackboard and turning on the lights. So let's just maybe record one of the definitions of stresses. So again, the framework. Position profile view for each vertex. And a stress factor. I actually want to make it a little more finer. For each edge, for each pair of vertices connected by an edge, we have a number. And we say it's an equilibrium if this basic condition is true. And then, one crucial thing is to, you know, we have numbers associated to each edges. I want to rearrange this into a matrix. Into what's called a stress matrix, not surprisingly. So if I have my framework here, I have numbers on each of these edges here. I put the corresponding numbers on the sort of off-diagonal entries here. So 1 is connected to 2, 3, and 4. It'll be a symmetric matrix, so we'll have these four weights on these four places and these four places. So omega of UV is going to be 0 if UV is not an edge. It's going to be our stress if it is an edge. And if U is equal to V, I want to arrange so that the sum of the rows of the matrix is equal to 0. So the negative, the sum of the other entries. And so we'll have zeros at the non-edges and then fill it out like so. For this example. And then the equilibrium condition in this language becomes very nice. It just becomes the statement that omega, this matrix here, times rho is equal to 0, where rho is the V by D matrix of the coordinates. So this is a V by D symmetric stress matrix. And so the key point that we'll be working with is that will be related to the conditions are the properties of this matrix here. So, and in particular, what's its dimension, what's its kernel, and maybe it's positive semi-definite. So the kernel, so if omega is an equilibrium stress matrix. There are always some vectors that we know are in the kernel. So we always know that the vector 1 of all 1s and the each coordinate projection of my framework, that these vectors are in the kernel. Omega times rho is equal to 0, so this says each of the columns of rho is in the kernel, and furthermore, the sum of each rho is equal to 0 by our choice, which says that this is in the kernel. So in particular, the dimension of the kernel of omega is at least d plus 1 if rho is a proper d-dimensional framework. By proper here, I just mean that its affine span is actually d dimensions rather than something smaller, which if you work it out, is essentially saying that these vectors are linearly independent. And so now I can state the main theorems. And I'll state the various theorems due to various people. So the first theorem due to Connolly is that if you have a generic framework which has a has an equilibrium stress matrix omega of rank the biggest it could be, d minus, where the kernel is d plus 1, the rank is d minus d minus 1, then rho is globally rigid. If you assume instead that it has a stress matrix omega of rank of the same rank, d minus d minus 1, and which is also positive semi-definite, then rho is universally rigid. Well, okay, so notice here I had to assume that the framework was generic. Here I don't have to assume it's generic, but I do need to assume a tiny bit more. I don't want to say it precisely, but it's something much weaker than just than saying it's generic. Rho. D-dimensional framework. What?
In the first line? If it's generic, then this has rank r minus d minus 1?
Sorry, b. It's a framework of a graph with b vertices. Our matrix here is a v by v matrix, where v is the number of vertices. And so, I mean, if it has a kernel this big, then its rank is that big. And this is also due to Connolly. And then the newer results are converses to both of these. So. The first is that rho, again with the same assumptions, framework of a d-dimensional framework with v vertices, and it is globally rigid, then it has the stress omega of rank of that maximal rank. And finally, that's a converse to the first one, and then the converse to the last one is that if rho is generic and universally rigid, then it has a positive semi-definite stress equilibrium stress matrix omega of rank v minus d minus 1. Yes? Yes. Right. So I guess the two cases are different. So in this case, there's some linear, this condition is linear in both rho and omega. So there's some vector space of possible omegas. So in fact, any generic omega will have this rank. In this case, whereas in this case, it's really in existence. There's some open set of there's an open set. I'm not actually sure of that. Anyway, there is at least one omega. And so global rigidity is equivalent to having, so really this is an if and only if, at least for generic frameworks, that a generic framework is globally rigid if and only if it has a high rank stress, and it's universally rigid if and only if it has a positive semi-definite high rank stress. And notice one difference between these two cases. So this was a generic property. I mean, so we're just talking about ranks of matrices. We're not really talking about any sort of inequalities. It doesn't depend on the framework, as we saw, as I asserted before. Whereas this one, we want it to be positive semi-definite, which does depend on the particular embedding. So just some comments on computability. So these two cases, globally rigid is equivalent to the existence of omega of rank b minus d minus 1. So this is a quite pleasant condition to check. In particular, you know, you don't even need to work with reals. I could work with sort of an arbitrary, sufficiently large field, and it will still work as well. So I could work modulo some prime if I wanted to. So we can check this efficiently. In fact, I had some undergraduates working on this over the summer, and they did. They went ahead and checked this for several classes, and you know, we found several new graphs, new sort of interesting failures of global rigidity. In dimension 4, and infinitely many in dimensions greater than or equal to 5. So by interesting, I mentioned that there were some relatively easy sufficient conditions for global rigidity, but they're not necessary, and there's still only one example where it fails, where those sufficient but not necessary condition fail in dimension 3, which is the graph K5. This is the only example I thought I'd give it, but, I don't know. I think there should be more, but we didn't find any yet. And whereas for the other case, for universal rigidity, it's an interesting condition, but there's this slight problem with it. So universal rigidity was equivalent to the existence of a positive 7 definite omega of high rank, the highest rank it could be. And there's a slight problem with this, which is that we already know that universal rigidity is, we can solve, if we can test for universal rigidity by solving a positive semi-definite programming problem. And so we turn one positive semi-definite programming problem into another positive semi-definite programming problem. So what was the advantage? So the real advantage is that, well, this gets a little bit more into the theory of positive semi-definite programming than I want to say much about, but you have what's called strict complementarity. So for positive semi-definite programming, like for linear programming, for every program, there's a dual program of a sort of complementary dimension. And you hope that you get ranks that are complementary to each other. And this is true in this case. And this is the sort of thing, one of the basic theorems of linear programming, which is always true for linear programming. It's not always true for semi-definite programming, which is one of the reasons why semi-definite programming is sort of not as pleasant. Okay, so let me, okay, so let's, let me, so let, so there's a lot, so let me now say a little bit at least about the proof of theorem 4. And we'll also see some of the techniques that come up in the proof of theorem 3. And the key concept is what's called the measurement set. So we have some space of frameworks. We have a space of d-dimensional frameworks, which I'll call configurations in dimension d. And it's just isomorphic to r to the d times v. And now, we can measure the length of the edges of the, let's measure the length of the edges of the, in the graph. And really, I want to say, measure the edge length squared, because that's an algebraic function. Because that's an algebraic function rather than a linear function, rather than, you know, no square roots. And so let me define M sub d of gamma to be the image of L, the superscript L corresponding to that graph. And another thing that I want to look at is M of, these are nested in each other. As I go up in dimension, I get more and more possible edge length measurements. And let's just take the limit. Image of L gamma for d large enough so that I can get all possible edge lengths. Say d equals d is large enough. And one nice property here is that these are sort of iterated chord varieties of each other. So if I take one-dimensional, for any d-dimensional framework, the edge lengths squared of any edge are going to be the sums of the squares of the various one-dimensional coordinate projections. So this will be kind of an iterated secant variety of the one-dimensional one. And in particular, this limit thing is convex. And in fact, it's equal to the convex hull of the one-dimensional edge length measurements. And one important special case is when I take the complete graph. On the same set of vertices. So there, it's not hard to see that the measurement set here of this complete graph, I'm just measuring all the edge lengths squared, and that's in fact equivalent to the space of semi-definite matrices. So this is in fact, you can identify this nicely with the positive semi-definite matrices, and it turns out of one smaller dimension. And this, which is a particularly nice space, and so we have, you know, some nice set here. Some nice convex set here, and projecting down to some flatter one. Well, okay. There's a projection from M of KV from the complete graph. I can just forget the edge length measurements on some of the edges. You know, this is going from R to the V choose 2, all possible edges, and I just forget the measurements on some of the edges, and I get something in R to the E. And so there's some projection. And we have two convex sets related by a projection, and that's the setting in which we'll need to work. Right, so now there are some, there are all these convex sets around, and so now you go off for a few months and you read your textbooks about convex sets. And in fact, there are all sorts of great things about convex sets, which I hadn't known this before. Any closed convex set has a natural dimension. The smallest affine subspace is 6 inside. And furthermore, convex sets, you can stratify them. And in fact, in natural ways. So we say that, so if C is a closed convex set, subset of R to the N, and we have some point X and C, we say that X is K extreme if it's not the interior of any, not in the interior of any K plus one simplex. So this takes some time to wrap your head around, so let's do a few examples. So here's the convex set I'd like. It's a racetrack, two straight edges on top and bottom, and two semicircular arcs at left and right. So if we take this point here is not in the interior, it's a point, but it's not in the interior of any interval. It can't be written as a proper convex combination of any other two points. So this is said to be zero extreme. This point here is in the interior of an interval. It's not in the interior of any triangle. So this is one extreme. And whereas this point here is in the interior of a triangle, so it's two extreme. So you naturally divide up the convex set in this way. And there's another division. We also say that a point is K exposed if it is not, if there is a half space with containing X, and the dimension of the intersection being less than or equal to K. So this is one easy way to see that it's K extreme. So for this point here, for instance, I could take this half space, everything to the left, and if this were in the interior of any simplex, the simplex has to be sitting inside this half space, but the only point that it intersects in is that single point, so it has to be zero extreme. For this point, I can take this half space up here, which intersects in a line segment, so it couldn't be in the interior of a triangle, and here I could just take any half space containing the whole thing. So here, zero extreme, there's zero extreme, they're also zero exposed, one exposed, and two exposed. But these two concepts don't always agree. And here's, if we look at this boundary point, right where it turns the corner, that's an example where it doesn't agree. So this point here, it's not in the interior of any interval, so this is zero extreme. However, it's not zero exposed because the best half space I could do would be this lower half space. So it's only one exposed. Just for other terminology you may have seen, this terminology zero extreme, this is also called being a vertex of the convex set. And again, it's the same as saying it's not a convex linear combination of any other points. And the crucial theorem so that we'll use. So this was proved for the zero exposed by Strashevitz, and the hardest part, of course, is spelling the name. And then for, in general, by Asplund, dating back to the 50s, is that K exposed implies K extreme. That's easy to say, to see, but the K exposed points are dense in the K extreme points. Are dense in the k-extreme points. So almost every vertex is exposed. That was Strashevitz, with k equals zero. And then the generalization was due to Asplund. And let me also mention that in our context, we're talking about convex sets, which are also semi-algebraic sets. So here, and these k-exposed and k-extreme sets are also both semi-algebraic sets. And so if we have a dense, one semi-algebraic set contained as a dense subset of another, that in particular implies that if C is algebraic, then the generic extreme points are also K exposed. Which is how this ties in with our theorem. I mean, and so this assumption of genericity is crucial. It's not true otherwise. And that's essentially what's going to give us the strength. Okay. So I'm not going to finish the proof, but I do at least want to give you some idea of what's going on. So the first is, so I want to relate these two concepts of being K-extreme and K-exposed to, you know, the two halves of this theorem being universally rigid and having a positive semi-definite stress. So, right, so as I mentioned, M of K is nice. It's this positive semi-definite cone. And you can classify the K-extreme points inside the semi-definite cone. So, if I have some matrix A, which is a positive semi-definite matrix, then A will be, if the rank of A is equal to K, that turns out to be equivalent to saying that A is K choose two exposed. Possibly I'm missing a K choose two extreme, which in turn is equivalent to saying that it's K choose two exposed. There's no difference between these two concepts. Every face is exposed, but I haven't defined that term. And that also corresponds to, you know, in this relation between frameworks and positive semi-definite matrices, that in turn corresponds to the saying that the corresponding framework is in dimension k minus 1. So, and then furthermore, so that was in terms of matrices. Now, if we have some framework rho, which is universally rigid, what does that mean? That means, so, we have this projection between these two convex sets, and upstairs, that completely determines the geometry, and downstairs, we have some point, some particular point, and saying it's universally rigid says exactly that there's exactly only one point upstairs above that point. So there's only one point in M of K above the corresponding point, the length measurements. And so you use this and you work a little bit more and you see that rho being universally rigid also tells you that L of rho is D plus 1 choose 2 extreme. I think we do need a little more in order to get this, but it's not far from saying that you're D plus 1 choose 2 extreme. On the other hand, being exposed, it turns out, is equivalent to this half space here. So I just want to close by saying that relationship. That if so, if you have any function on the edges, and we can turn it into a corresponding matrix, the same way we turned with row sum zero. So I want to think about psi as a function on the edges. So I want to think about this in the dual to this edge length measurement space. So this edge length measurements took me into R to the E. Now I think about this function as in the dual of there. And now the little lemma, which is a really straightforward calculation, is that if I apply this linear function to the length measurements of a framework, that's equal to basically the corresponding bilinear form applied to rho. So there's this nice correspondence between stresses and linear functionals given by this equation. And then from there, it's not hard to see that if you having a stress matrix of rank V minus D minus 1 is equivalent to being D plus 1 choose 2 exposed. There's more to say, but let me stop here.
Yes. Can I have a question? So